I invite you to join me in our morning scripture reading, coming this morning from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, and then moving ahead to chapter 7, verses 10 to 18. Beginning with chapter 1, I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Chapter 7, verse 10. Do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this: wisdom preserves those who have it. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this: God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these, the righteous perishing in their righteousness and the wicked living long in their wickedness. Do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Do not be over-wicked, and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It is good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. Whoever fears God will avoid all extremes. Where do you go when you have a question? I guess where I go when I have a question is I go to you in a sermon, apparently, but where do you go? You would probably answer, well, that depends where I'm most likely to find an answer. So if you're looking to bake bread, you go to a recipe. If you want to learn how to play disc golf, you look for the rules or look for someone else who loves to play disc golf. If you want to know what the number one song on the Billboard music chart was this week in 1997, you maybe go to Google for that. And by the way, Mbop by Hanson, in case you children of the 90s were wondering. If you want to know the answer to the question, what's for dinner? Well, you can ask Alexa that, but you're probably better off to ask the maker of the dinner. What about the question, what is the meaning of life? Where do you go for an answer to that? In the tongue-in-cheek science fiction novel, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there is a supercomputer called Deep Thought, who in the story has been processing that question, looking for the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And this computer has been at the task for 7.5 million years, as the novel portrays it. And the computer has been checking and double-checking its figures and calculations and computations and finally comes out with this, the answer to the meaning of life. The meaning of life is, according to Deep Thought, 42. And someone, when Deep Thought announces this, shouts, 42? Is that all you've got to show for 7.5 million years of figuring? And Deep Thought's response is, well, I checked it very thoroughly, and that quite definitely is the answer. I think the problem, to be quite honest with you, is that you've never actually known what the question is. So, to the question, what is the meaning of life? And specifically, where do you go if you want to know the meaning of life? Well, you would expect that the church answer would be, you go to God, of course. You go to God for the answer. Well, what if you took that option off the table? What if God was distant and uninvolved in the world? What if life under the sun, life here in this world, was all there is, was all that we could see, was all that we could know? What if we were left to sort big questions like that out all by ourselves? Well, that's essentially the perspective that comes through in the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible. Ecclesiastes is part of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, so it's the older, wiser sages passing along counsel to the youth of the day. It's written by the teacher. We introduced ourselves to it last week. If you missed that sermon, you might want to go back and catch up. The teacher is how he identifies himself. I said last week that the teacher was either the Israelite King Solomon, who was one of the richest, wisest men to ever live. It was either King Solomon or it was a writer or an editor who was communicating as if he was King Solomon. From the persona of this rich and wise, unmatched man, legendary king. And the teacher is seeking to convey to us the meaning of life under the sun. That is life without God. Life when all that we see and know is what we can observe with our eyes, what we see in this world. Now, to be clear, the teacher isn't promoting that perspective. He's not promoting the idea that, you know, all that we can know is what's here right before us. Rather, what he's trying to do is to help us realize that life with God is what we really need. And the method by which he's trying to communicate that to us is by laying out for us the emptiness of life without God. And so as we see the two together, his hope is that those who read his words will come to the place of saying, wow, why would we even want the possibility of life without God when we have the possibility of life with him? And so he starts in chapter 1 with that message that it's probably not going to make it into very many graduation speeches this time of year. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And of course, that's meaningless is just, it's a puff of smoke. It's insubstantial. It's here and then it's gone. That is the perspective of life under the sun. And so the teacher wants to experiment with different ways of living life under the sun and looking for meaning under the sun. And so over the course of the 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes, the teacher looks into pleasure and power and leisure and work and money and relationships and religion, looks into all of these ways that we might, even today, seek to find meaning in our lives. But of course, the difference between the teacher and you and me today is if the teacher is coming from the perspective of Solomon, well, then he had virtually unlimited resources to pursue all of those opportunities for meaning to the extreme. So the teacher, from Solomon's perspective, could experience the most pleasure. He could have the most power. He could have wealth unrivaled. He could pursue all of these things to their extreme and then come back to us and say, you know, those things are not necessarily in and of themselves bad. They're not in and of themselves sinful, but they're ultimately unsatisfying. So we're going to be touching down in this book for many of our summer sermons and trying to look into the main arguments that the teacher is making and learn from them about life without God, so that we can ultimately have a better grasp and hopefully appreciation of life with God. And the starting point, as we delve into some of the specifics, is an area that King Solomon was well known for, and that was wisdom. For being able to take knowledge and apply it to real life situations, that's wisdom.
It's being able to take what you know and put it into action. It's being able to take what you know and use it to make decisions that impact how you live your life. That's wisdom. Solomon was known for that. And so he starts in chapter 1 and then again in chapter 7 by talking about wisdom and a life dedicated to wisdom. Now understand, when he talks about wisdom in these chapters, most often he's talking not about wisdom that comes as kind of a special revelation from God, but he's talking about wisdom as we observe it, just, you know, as we look around, as we see what's happening in the world, and we try to make sense of it. That's the kind of wisdom that he's talking about. And in verse 13 of chapter 1, he says, I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. Sounds pretty comprehensive, doesn't it? I mean, he wanted to be able to give us a full report of what is life devoted to wisdom, to seeking meaning through wisdom. What does that look like? And so he wanted to leave no stone unturned. And we see that in several of the verses here, he has very positive things to say about wisdom. It's like an inheritance. It's a good thing. It's a shelter. It preserves those who have it. Wisdom is good. But of course, his conclusions more often tend to be negative. Chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And then he has this interesting proverb in verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. So the teacher says that when you're wise, when you have really taken on the wisdom that can be gained in this world, you come to know several things. And one of the things that you come to know when you make wisdom your pursuit is you realize how crooked things really are and how hard they are to straighten. You know, and we know this. Life can get crooked in all kinds of ways. People get hurt. Relationships are strained. There are illnesses and accidents and power struggles. And we don't get what we want, and then we get what we don't want. Life can be crooked. And sometimes the crookedness of life, the bentness of life can come because of our own sin or because of somebody else's sin that affects us. Sometimes it's just circumstances. It's the result of circumstances beyond our control, and we can't like pin fault on any one person. And the wise begin to realize how quickly and easily things can go sideways, how easy it is for things to get crooked in this world. And you probably don't need them, but consider some examples. I came across an article a few months ago called Why American Teens Are So Sad, looking at four forces that contribute to the rising rates of depression among teenagers. And I'll just mention one of the four. One of those four forces that is making teens sad is teenagers' perception of the world around them that seems to be causing them stress. And here's what the article says. News sources have never been more abundant or more accessible. But journalism also has a famous bad news bias, which flows from the reality that negativity generally gets more attention. When we plug our brains into a news feed, we are usually choosing to deluge ourselves with negative representations of reality. So we cannot rule out the possibility that teens are sad about the world, not only because the world contains sadness, but also because young people have 24/7 access to sites that are constantly telling them they should be depressed about it. Why are we so sad? Well, maybe it's like the teacher says in chapter 1, verse 18. With much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. And now, you know, we can know just about anything. You know, the news is just a click away. And so some people respond the way the teacher mentions in chapter 7, verse 13. You know, why were the old days better than these? If only we could go back to the old days. And yet the teacher says, don't say that. Because previously he said, you know, nothing really ever changes. We keep dealing with the same stuff. We just keep circling around, and maybe it seems like things are new, but at foundation, things never really are different. So, you know, you might think the old days were better, but were they really better? For whom were they better? Is it possible that you know, our memories do what they do, and they idealize the past? We have a way of you know, filtering out certain memories and so remembering things in a certain light. And in all the days, good or bad, we can find what he describes in chapter 7, verse 15. We can find the righteous who perish in their righteousness while the wicked live on long in their wickedness. We live in a crooked kind of world. And that's the curse of wisdom, is that we see how crooked things really are. When you're wise, you know that. Also, when you're wise, not only do you know how crooked things are, but you know how incapable you are of fixing things. How incapable you are of fixing what is crooked. You ever tried to bend back into shape something crooked? So, a new chapter for you in Adam's Home Maintenance Dilemmas. This lovely little hook that you see is a towel hook in our bathroom. We have a set of three of them mounted on a base to the wall, and been there for years. You see, this one's not on the wall anymore, don't you? Well, the screw came loose, and so, you know, towel gets hung on it, and whoop, it flips around and dumps the towel. So, our nice straight towel rack, towel hook is crooked. So I did as I do and tried to figure out how to fix this, and what I discovered is that in order to fix it, I mean, you have to be able to screw it back in. You need to be able to access the head of the screw, but the head of the screw is behind the mount. And so in order to be able to screw the hook back in the way that it's supposed to be so that it's straight again, I would have to actually take the whole thing off the wall so I can access the screw head and tighten it and then put it back on. Well, I didn't even put the thing on the wall. And so my confidence in my ability to get it back on the wall after fixing the hook is not real great. When it comes to a crooked hook, I'm conscious of how incapable I am of fixing it. I'm sure I'll figure it out eventually, but you ever tried to take a bent plastic spoon and fix it? You know, sometimes we try to fix what is bent, and we end up breaking it. We make it worse. Philip Ryken, a commentator, says, there are people we can't manage. There are problems we can't solve. There are pressures we can't escape. The second part of that proverb in chapter 1, verse 15, it says, what is crooked can't be straightened, but what is lacking cannot be counted. In other words, you can't count what you don't have. And often we don't have the resources that we need to be able to straighten out what is bent. Maybe we don't have the knowledge or the insight to know what to do to straighten it. Or maybe we know what it would take, but we don't have the power or the control to be able to do it. I'm convinced that I could make the world a better place. Not a perfect place, but a better place. If only everyone had to do exactly what I say. I think I could fix some things if I could make every person in the world do exactly what I say. But of course, I don't have that power, and Maybe it's good that I don't. Maybe it's good that I don't. And the reality is that a wise person recognizes not only how incapable we are of fixing the things that are crooked in the world, but also realizes how complicated it is just to change yourself. I mean, you know, I wish I could control all kinds of things, but I can't even always control myself. One of these mornings, I'm going to get up and go for a run again. But it wasn't this morning, and it probably won't be tomorrow. I wish that I read more, and I wish that I cared less about keeping the peace, and I wish that I was more in touch with my emotions. And you probably have your own list of things that you wish were true of you. In the church, we have lots of discipleship ministries, and the focus of those ministries ultimately is trying to help people become more like Jesus. But you know, so many of our discipleship ministries in the church, and this isn't just our church, this is the church, so many of them are based on the idea that if we just give people the right information, then they will change. Just need to give them the right truth, the right teaching, and they will change. But the reality is, we have access to more teaching than probably any other generation in history. I mean, you can live stream services from anywhere and find all kinds of great preaching, probably some that's not as great too, but you can find all kinds of preaching. You can listen to podcasts and you can watch TED Talks. You can find it all. And yet I would suggest to you the evidence is suggesting that all of that information is not necessarily leading to greater transformation in people. And the teacher experienced that in Ecclesiastes in chapter 7, verse 23. He said, "All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, I am determined to be wise. But this was beyond me, and it's beyond us." Now, there's the kind of the setup for us. These are the kinds of things that wise people know. Wise people who look around, observe the world. These are the kinds of things that we figure out. And some of you hear that and you think, yes, you know, this teacher really gets it. I mean, he sees things for the way they really are. And some of you, you know, hear this and you think, this is so depressing. Like, do I have to come to church and be depressed? Like, what? Well, I want to turn the corner for those of you in the second category particularly. That's not where I want to end today, because we don't just have the wisdom of life under the sun. We have what one of the New Testament writers calls wisdom that comes down from heaven. And in chapter 7 in particular, in his talk about wisdom, the teacher offers us some nuggets of that kind of wisdom. In chapter 7, verse 13, the teacher writes, "Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked?" Now, that's an interesting statement, because that's an awful lot like what the teacher said back in chapter 1, verse 15. Here he's saying what God has made crooked. But back in chapter 1, verse 15, he was just talking about what is crooked. So here he's acknowledging God. And he's suggesting that if you believe, like the teacher does, that God is not distant and unengaged in the world, if you believe that the teacher is, that God is actually present and involved in the world, then in some cases, he will be actively involved in the things that are crooked. And we may not understand all his reasons for doing what he does, but he is actively involved. In other cases, maybe he's not actively involved in making things crooked, but he's allowing them to be crooked. And the point is that when you have true wisdom from God, you see that he can be at work in all of it, even in the crookedness. He goes on in chapter 7, verse 14, to talk about God's activity. He says, when times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider God has made the one as well as the other. And so he's suggesting for us a few principles of life with God. We've kind of looked at where wisdom takes us without God. Where does wisdom take us with God? I'd offer you two observations there. First of all, when you have God-given wisdom, you base your confidence in the good God, not the good times. You base your confidence in the good God, not the good times. There are moments of goodness in every life. And so the teacher says, let's enjoy life as fully as we can. When times are good, be happy. You know, in a week like the one we just had, when I get on Facebook and I scroll down, and I don't try not to do this too much, but when I do, you go from post to post, and there's this dissonance. On one hand, there's a whole lot of lamenting. Lamenting the shooting in Texas. And you can find articles and comments and responses. We should respond this way, or we should respond that way. You have all of that on one hand, and then, you know, in the midst of the heaviness, you scroll to the next post, and it's, you know, congratulations on your graduation, and celebrating your anniversary with you, and baby shower, and you can feel kind of like jarred, just being pulled from one extreme to the other. And you might even think, well, how can people celebrate when awful things are happening in our world? Well, the teacher would say to us, I believe, know that God is present and active in both the good times and in the bad times. And at any moment, right now, there are people in the world having good times and there are people in the world having bad times. I talked with a woman at a funeral on Thursday. It was her uncle's funeral. And she was telling me that just at 9 a.m. that same morning, she became a grandma for the first time. Her daughter was in the hospital and had a baby. Good times and bad times, almost the same time. We so easily put our confidence in the good times. You know, we think that life should always be this way. It should always be good. And we get rattled when bad things come. And we think, how could this happen? And the teacher would say to us from his God-given wisdom, when you are in the good moments, enjoy them. Make the most of them. Offer thanks to God for them. And do that without the feeling that you're somehow betraying those who are suffering. And certainly, don't base your confidence in the good times. And don't live as if you are only owed good times. Because bad times will come. They do. And when the bad comes, mourn and lament. And when bad times come for others, empathize. But don't catastrophize as if God has suddenly turned traitor or doesn't exist because something bad has happened. Because our confidence is in God and his goodness for his children, whatever the times hold. In a hard time, maybe the goodness is just the motivation to do something about the root cause of the badness. Or maybe it's the comfort and the love of the community that you experience in the midst of the hardship. Or maybe it's pressing deeper into the transformation that God wants to work in you. But there's always goodness with God that he can work into the bad. God-given wisdom says, I don't have confidence in the good times because they come and I'm going to enjoy them when they do, and they go. but my confidence is in the goodness of God. And finally, when we talk about God-given wisdom, we have one advantage over the teacher, and that is we recognize that the pursuit of wisdom leads us to the person of Jesus. The pursuit of wisdom leads to the person of Jesus. James, the brother of Jesus, wrote these words, "If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you." These days, if you don't know what to pray for, a great thing to pray for would be for wisdom. Pray that you would have wisdom, that we would have wisdom together. Pray that the church of Jesus would have wisdom, that the leaders of the nations of the world would have wisdom. Pray for wisdom. But you know, as we pray for and as we pursue wisdom, that leads us to the person of Jesus. Paul wrote these words, "We preach Christ crucified." He's writing this to Christians. "Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." Jesus is wisdom personified. And you know, he saw life's crookedness up close, and he entered right into it. He entered into the crooked world, and he offered wisdom in his teaching about God's kingdom and the opportunities that we have to get in on what God is doing in the world. We, right as we are, can enter into God's kingdom. He offered us that wisdom, and then ultimately, as he became a victim of the crookedness of the world, hanging on a cross, he ultimately transformed the crookedness of the world and began the process of straightening it as he came down from the cross and then came out of the tomb. When it comes to big questions about the meaning of life and why things happen the way they do, it can be hard to sift out the answers. The second Mrs. Einstein was once asked if she understood her husband Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. And her response was, "No, I don't understand the theory of relativity. But I do understand Professor Einstein. And that's all I need." We will not understand everything in this life. There's so much mystery under the sun. But when we are pursuing Jesus, the wisdom of God, when we are trusting in the goodness of God, we might just be surprised to find in this life under the sun that that's enough. Would you pray with me? Thank you, O God, for the teacher, for both the points he raises that challenge us and for the encouragement to find the wisdom we need for this life in you. Oh, Lord, I pray that in the midst of a crooked world that we just can't fix, and in the midst of the crookedness of our own lives that it's so hard to change, may our confidence be not in good times, not even in our own goodness, but in your goodness, O God. May we pursue you, O Jesus, and find that in you, in you, we really can have all that we need as we look to you and find our strength and our help in you. May we find it there, Jesus. In your name we ask it. Amen.